This episode of the DTFH is brought to you by Squarespace.com. Head to Squarespace.com, and when you're ready to launch, use offer code Duncan to get 10% off your website or domain. Hello, my dearest listener, and thank you for steering the skiff of your mind into the glowing phosphorescent waters of the lagoon that is the Duncan Trussell Family Hour podcast. Look, we all know that it's only a matter of time before the San Andreas Fault cracks open and robotic super intelligent spiders come skittering across California, blasting fiery beams of flesh disintegrating light into anyone who crosses their paths. We know that it's only a matter of time before somewhere in some laboratory at Google, a swarm of nanobots escapes and runs amok through our sweet planet Earth, reconfiguring us at the atomic level and transforming us from human beings into quivering cubes of multi-eyeballed, screaming bits of plasmatic goo. And before this happens, many of us are probably going to get arrested and fisted by Jeff Sessions in his own personal deluxe private prison cell, where he shows up from time to time when he needs to blow off steam from a hard day of making plants illegal and just relax. And somebody like Jeff Sessions, all you've got to do is spend a few seconds looking at any picture of him to know that that guy has got a leather bodysuit that he keeps in a secret closet in his office in Washington. And at the end of the day, he zips that thing on, squeezes a butt plug underneath his desk, and a set of stairs opens up in the wall, which he descends. And there he has a torture room filled with imprisoned farmers who he fists all night long while whispering strange southern sayings in their ears. Oh, you know, sometimes when the bird egg cracks, the birdie flies. But sometimes when the crack stays shut, the birdie dies. These people hate Mother Earth, friends, and they're doing everything they can to keep us sick. But the good news is this. Existing in this world as a kind of reflection to the Jeff Sessions and Trumps and all the other weird, doughy men out there who just want to kick us in the fucking heart chakra until we turn into pillars of calloused stone, there exists messengers of love and light and teachers who are there for us whenever we're ready to make the descent from the prison cell of the mind, where we fist ourselves every single day, into the sweet chambers of the heart. Today's guest is one of these people, whether he'll admit to it or not. He runs the Love Serve Remember Foundation, which puts on the meditation retreats that I go to twice a year. And he's a really dear friend of mine and also a great teacher of mine. So I really enjoyed this conversation. I'm excited to share it with you. We're going to jump right into it, but first, some quick business. Today's episode of the DTFH is brought to you by the web gurus over at Squarespace.com. Head over to Squarespace.com for a free trial, and when you're ready to launch, use offer code Duncan to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or a domain. Now, I don't want to get all dark and forensic files in the middle of a Squarespace commercial here, but I did just read that in the tropics, somebody hired a charlatan web designer. There's a lot of great web designers out there. Some of you are great web designers, but you guys are pretty expensive, and you deserve to be paid a lot because you've spent years honing the craft and the technical skills involved in making a website. But there's also a lot of people out there who claim to be web designers, and one of these people was Roberto Tomar Lenore, who lived in a small island in the tropics. He was putting up signs that he could build websites for people, and I guess somebody hired him and wasn't pleased with the work that he did. And so one afternoon, he broke into the guy's house, dragged him out of the house. I think he like injected him with some kind of sedative or tranquilizer, dragged him out of the house into the jungle, and took him and did this, I don't know if you've ever heard of this thing that these charlatan web designers will do to their disgruntled customers who want their money back, but it's called canoeing. And basically they take two canoes, they fill them up with meat and honey and sugar, they cut holes in the sides, and they take their disgruntled customers and they put them in the canoes and they chain the canoes together, their arms sticking out the sides, and then their disgruntled customers are gradually dissolved and eaten by maggots and bugs and rats that climb in through the armholes because they're drawn by the smell of the prisoners' fear diarrhea and the sugar and the honey. It's very sad, but it's the kind of danger you put yourself in when you make the decision to hire a charlatan web designer. These frauds have been blasting rails of black market Adderall for months. They don't know they are. They think they're some combination of Jesus and a Pegasus, and they will trample all over your life. Thank God for Squarespace.com, where you can use their award-winning templates to make anything that you want to. It doesn't just have to be a business website. You can make prank websites. On the last episode, I mentioned asshypnotist.com. It's gone now, and I'm sure that whoever bought that domain name is going to make millions of dollars within the next few months. You can turn your cool idea into a new website, showcase your work, blog or publish content, promote your online or physical business, announce an upcoming event, or just make a cool website for your folks. Somebody sent me a website that they'd made for their dad. It's actually a pretty cool gift that you can give people. All you got to do is go to squarespace.com, use offer code Duncan, you'll get 10% off your first purchase of a website or a domain. And if you want to see a beautiful Squarespace website, go no further than duncantrussell.com. Thanks for sponsoring this episode, Squarespace. Also, a tremendous thank you to those of you who have subscribed to us over at patreon.com. If you want to get commercial-free episodes of the DTFH, head over to patreon.com/DTFH and sign up. Also, I upload rambles and monologues and weird stuff up there, things that I'm afraid to put on the main feed because I'm afraid of seeming like an embarrassing sap. But if you want to hear some sappy rambles, head over to patreon.com/DTFH and sign up. We also have an Amazon link located at duncantrussell.com. Thank you for those of you who continue to use that link. I just was made aware that if you have an ad blocker up, you're not going to see the link located at duncantrussell.com. You can scroll down. I'm going to figure out a way to make it more obvious. For those of you who have figured out how to go through that link, my thanks to you. When you click through that link and buy something from Amazon, they give us a very small percentage of that, and it costs you nothing. If you turn off your ad blocker, go to duncantrussell.com, you'll see a list of cool things, things I like, books I like, virtual reality goggles. If you buy any of those things, or if you just click on that link and buy anything at all, they give us a small percentage of it, and it's a great way for you to support the DTFH. And finally, if you want to go really deep, then why not head over to Maui in the spring for the Ram Dass Spring Retreat? I'm going to be there. Raghu Marcus, today's guest, is going to be there. Robert Thurman, who's a great Buddhist teacher, is going to be there. Krishna Das is going to be there. All of that data can be found over at ramdass.org. All right, pals, without further ado, please welcome to the Duncan Trussell Family Hour podcast today's esteemed guest, Raghu Marcus. Raghu, my teacher, welcome back to the DTFH.
Duncan, my guru, happy to be here. Happy to be anywhere, as Keith Richards says.
Okay, Raghu, can you hear me?
Yes, I can, sir.
Okay, I just want to dive right into it with you. My question for you is a question that's very basic, but that I've never asked you. What is the present moment?
That's interesting, because I was just discussing that with Dr. Gabor Mate yesterday, the day before, when I did a mind rolling podcast with him. Do you know him?
I've heard of him, but I'm not familiar with him.
Yeah, major psychiatrist, addiction expert. So what he did, he kind of got me into a therapy. Do you mind, he said, if I talk to you about your personal life? I said, oh, okay, as long as it helps everybody, I guess. And he got into my father and my mother, and he yelled at me, and he made me crazy, and what did I do? I recoiled. And then he said, well, what did you do after that to try and, you know, soothe this extreme wounded experience? And I told him, I got into football. I loved football. That's what got me away from the insanity of being in my house, my father. Anyhow, it was a pretty extraordinary experience. But at one point, we talked about how everyone has an addiction. Addiction isn't about junkies. Everyone has a place that they're run away from to get away from some wounded part of themselves, right?
Yes.
And what it comes down to is it's getting away from just being completely ensconced, or as Ram Dass puts it, burrowed into the moment, which means you are not thinking of anything from the past or the future, and you're not running, and you're not trying to fill that moment with something else. So, I mean, and it's not just sitting down and being in the moment like meditating or something. It's like what you're doing, you're completely inhabiting the moment of what that doing is consciously, which is all about mindfulness. So most of the time we're doing everything we can not to inhabit that moment, because that moment, you know, may have pain. It may have past references that are, you know, that come at you, that your mind goes towards, and it, you know, so we're just trying to avoid suffering on a day-to-day basis each moment. So yeah, that's what the moment is, just being able to be here now.
That pain that you're talking about that happens in the present moment, for you, did it ever go away, or is it always there, that wound you're talking about?
Yeah, I'm considering these answers so I can be really as real as possible. You know, it's so easy to give these pat kind of, you know, answers to questions like this. Yes, there, as time has passed for me since my reference point, of course, as you know, and maybe even some of your audience knows too, when I went to India with Ram Dass after he went back the second time and met Neem Karoli Baba, that's my reference point for the rest of my life. So the any moments that have accumulated where I wasn't distracted either by desire, attachment, suffering, or whatever, I have to attribute to whatever transmission I got by being around such a being that was always in the moment. The lesson of that was so powerful, not that any of us tried to emulate that in that way, but certainly we took on the awareness that we were given and the practices that we were given, and we, you know, moved forward through time. And there's many, many moments that have gotten even more, there's more of a surplus of them as time has gone on, because I think it's because I less care about what I'm thinking, much less self-consciousness about whatever it is emotionally that's going on. I'm not as attached to that part of myself that is at, you know, is really at the beck and call of thoughts, emotions, and that reality, which I thought was reality. So that's less and less and less part of my intrinsic reflection of who I really am. You know, I'm much more able to just be here because I'm not being pulled the way that I was pulled, you know, in the past. So, yeah, I would say that I have many, many more moments, and they happen more often. And at the same time, you know, listen, I've told you, I go to India to be able to inhabit that, you know, where I can go sit with an advanced being, and be in that, in their vibration where they are not caught whatsoever in duality, and therefore you can kind of just catch on to that wave, and there's no time and space, you're not thinking about yourself. So I spend as much time as possible every year doing that as a retreat, and hopefully that rubs off enough so that those moments happen while I'm here.
When you meditate, do you bring Neem Karoli Baba, your guru, to mind as you meditate? Or do you do a more basic practice like follow your breath or focus on your heartbeats? Or are you actively trying to bring Maharaji into your consciousness?
Yeah, I'd like to repeat what Sharon says. I like to try and get real. I've been doing more of that since, remember that you asked her that one day? What do you do when you sit down and meditate? Or sit down, what kind of practice do you do? And she said, I just sit down and try and get real.
I do remember that.
And we did that further when we were in New York at ABC, right? She called it, okay, let's talk about getting real. And that's really what it's all about. And as far as practice, yeah, I do use the Vipassana practice for sure as part of it. And certainly
Raghu, very quickly, just this is a terrible interruption, but I just want to settle it once and for all. Is it Vipassana or Vipassana?
You could go both ways. Vipassana, Vipassana.
Okay,
I've heard it both ways.
Okay, gotcha.
And I like Vipassana.
Yeah, I do too. I like it better too. I think Cornfield calls it Vipassana, I think, but I can't recall. But regardless, who cares?
Yeah.
For the listeners who aren't familiar with what that is, can you just describe it?
Okay, so it's basically in its most generality of definitions, general definition, insight meditation. So it's got a few components. The first component is simply, as you just said, following the breath or watching the rising and falling of your abdomen as you breathe naturally. And every time you get lost, you come back to that one point. And sooner or later, you have some kind of real concentration ability. Because until you have that, you can't meditate. There's no meditating. There's, you know, being lost in your thoughts and emotions. So that's the first.
Hold on a second. You're saying being lost in my thoughts and emotions isn't meditation?
It is for you, but not for everybody else.
I'm serious about that. Wait a second. This is really an important point here. Because my understanding of meditation has been it is not based on any kind of outcome or expectation of outcome. That the practice of sitting down, following the breath, watching the thoughts, watching the reaction to the thoughts, watching the arising and the falling of sounds and external phenomena, getting caught in the thoughts, getting caught in the phenomena, then coming back to the breath, that was a kind of continuum. And it sounds like you're saying that there is actually, you can meditate wrong or unsuccessful meditation. And am I misunderstanding you?
Yeah, no, I'm not trying to say that's wrong. I'm saying that once there is less discursive thought going on due to constant practice, right?
Yes.
The next stage of Vipassana is, you know, is going through the sensations in the body and scanning the body, right? That's the next stage.
Okay.
And then, you know, and then it goes stage to stage after that.
What's the stage after scanning the body?
You'll have to get a real Vipassana teacher, which I'm not, to tell you that stuff. But what does happen at some point, I only know my own experience.
Okay? Right.
So, and what does happen is there's a fluidity throughout my being. And I don't have any positional point that I'm referencing anymore. There's no breath, there's no rising, falling, there's no sensation, there's just the fluidity. And usually I end up, sometimes I end up in a place that's not, that fluidity takes me to a place just over the top of my head, and I'm kind of sitting in a very, what should we call it, peaceful, joyful, non-intrusive space. And for me, when that happens, that is when I do bring Neem Karoli Baba into my consciousness and just get into an absorption of that vibration, which I know well. You know, I mean, the physical times that I was with him, I remember as much as the time I was with you, like 2 weeks ago in Maui.
Right.
So
it's just permanently etched upon your heart.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like you're etched with him now. You can't leave his presence. You probably, if you wanted to.
Yeah. And that's not just me who saw him physically. It's anybody who see him in a dream. It doesn't matter. The physicality isn't the point. The vibrational quality is the point. So, yeah, so then, so that's my little sequence of my meditation, actually.
Do you imagine that, and this is something that Ram Dass was talking about, I want to talk to you about this. It's been coming to my mind ever since the retreat. And for those of you who didn't listen to the live stream or weren't at the retreat, one of the things Ram Dass brings up sometimes is this concept of the imagination or living with being in the heart space. And in the heart space, Raghu, I've noticed phenomenal things happen, beautiful things, such as feeling as though I'm in the presence of Neem Karoli Baba, but not just Neem Karoli Baba, sometimes other things too come into that space, and it's amazing and specific. And so I want to get your take, Raghu, on what this space is in comparison to the sort of normal space humans inhabit on a day-to-day basis. What is this place? Because you've taught me an awful lot about non-differentiation. But in the type of yoga I think you could say that you practice, it feels as though differentiation is necessary in the sense that the relationship between you and Neem Karoli Baba requires there to be a Neem Karoli Baba and a Raghu Marcus for the circuit to activate. Do you know what I'm saying? So
yeah. Yeah, you're talking about the path of duality. That's what this is. There is an object, and then this is a, you know, our path is a path of the heart, so it's a devotional attitude. There's a being of unconditionality, love, unconditional love, unconditionality in every way, and you are propitiating that being one way or the other through, you know, whatever practice. And in this case, where we just talked about the meditation that I use, and at the end, I am, there's not so much, I'm not trying to do anything, I'm just bringing that vibration into my consciousness over my head, and eventually, one expects that there will be a merging of sorts, which would be very useful when you die. So that's right. Very much, since I'm older now, you know, I am practicing that. So that will happen automatically when I do go out. So, but what's the quality of that heart opening? Is that, that's kind of, no, what you're saying, right?
Well, kind of. I guess I'm asking what that space is. Because, so for example, there's so many different forms of bhakti yoga. Some people it's Krishna, some people it's Ganesh.
Yeah, so many objects.
So many objects that you could...
A gazillion
objects. But, okay, now this is going to get woo-woo-y, but I don't think you're opposed to that. Maybe some of my listeners are.
No, I'm totally opposed to
that. Yeah, right. But I want to talk about this. When you, okay, so when you look at a deity, for example, in a space where the deity is being worshipped and has been worshipped for a very long time, or even on someone's puja table who is a devotee, if you're in the right state of consciousness, in other words, if you're not completely caught up in your head and you go into your heart space, whatever you want to call it, and you look at that deity, that thing's alive. And not a lot, it seems to be specifically alive, like aware, somehow sentient or something. It seems to be so real that it can make your hair stand on end. It's confusing. It can break your heart. So what is that phenomena? And where is the thing that's imbuing that inanimate object with sentience residing when it's not in that object?
All through my many, many, many tours through India over the years, I just never related with any of those statues. I just never did. Only twice in the whole time that I have spent time in India. I mean, being a little bit too dramatic, a few times. But the only thing I can give you an answer that makes some sense to me that's not woo-hoo. And that's what, there's a statue which is called Murti in Hindi, Sanskrit or Hindi, in Taos, New Mexico, that Ram Dass brought back, of Hanuman, right? It's been there since late 70s. In fact, yes. It's just getting a brand new temple finally where it'll get installed and where enough people can gather around. So, when I first encountered that statue, somehow, and it was installed in a cow shed, so it had it was just a plain adobe room that really was a cow shed that this guy, we bought his property. Those of us, were trying to put together a place for this Murti to be and a gathering spot of Neem Karoli Baba in this country. Which is just a fabulous place at this point. You haven't been there, right?
Not yet, but I want to go
up
there.
Yeah, no, it's a beautiful place. Anyhow, I can't tell you why I felt what I felt, but it was a powerful vibration. I mean, to this day, every time I step in that room, it's like I'm in the same room with the Neem Karoli Bob. And, and I know that sounds crazy and woohoo, but you know what? Here's what I do think is the reason for it. So many people, and in this case, mostly Westerners, although there's a lot of Indian people that come there as well from, who are living in America now. But so many people over so many years coming in and offering their love and devotion to what Hanuman represents to them. And where did that come from? That came from Neem Karoli Baba, from Maharaji. Because he's the one, we didn't know nothing from Hanuman when we went to India. We didn't know anything about anything.
But people, I mean, I'm sure there's people listening right now who don't know anything about Hanuman. Maybe you could describe right. this God to people? Because it's pretty far out, man.
Yeah, so, you know, it's a whole story. There's two big holy books in India. One's the Ramayana, one's the Bhagavatam. The Ramayana is the story of Ram, who came down to interact with humans as a king, and the other is Krishna. And many people know the Bhagavad Gita, or at least have heard of the Bhagavad Gita. So the story of Ram, loosely, is, you know, he came down and through some unusual circumstances had to be banished to a forest in India with his wife and his brother, and one of his other brothers took over being king, and his wife got abducted by Ravana, who lived in Ceylon in Lanka, which is called Lanka now, so he enlisted this powerful monkey that he encountered in the forest to go and find his wife, which he did, and came back and told Ram where his wife was, and Ram went with an army, and he vanquished the demons, you know, and it's kind of a basic adventure story.
Right.
With many, many, many levels. But what Maharaji told us, first of all, he told us over and over, Hanuman and Christ are the same. And what that meant, we could relate because we knew Christ represented self-sacrifice, love of mankind, and pure devotion to God.
And they were both monkeys.
Yeah. Well, one was a Jewish monkey.
Well, I mean, I guess humans are monkeys if you think about it.
Yeah, right, if you go back. Anyhow, the real point is that, and there's one part in the story which to me is the most important part of what Hanuman represents. When he came back to Ram to tell him, hey, I found Sita, I burnt down the city with the demons, and you can go get her, it's going to be no problem. So he said, Ram said to Hanuman, wow, nobody's ever done what you've done for me. I'll give you anything you want in any one of my universes. Anything. You just ask. And the monkey Hanuman fell at his feet saying, save me from the tentacles of the egoism. That's all he cared about, was eradication of self. He didn't want anything but that. And so that ideal was what was installed in us.
Was he given that? Did Ram give him that?
Yeah, he had that. I mean, he had that. He was.
Then why was he asking for it?
Well, it's just a play, Leela. He was just playing out for us the reality of what we all could aspire for. And so going back actually to your original question of what you know, the feelings that you get like going to the retreat in this wonderful group, and the heart feelings, and getting into a space where you can actually experience the divine substance, if you want to call it that. It's the complete subsuming of ego. Everyone there is not thinking about themselves so much anymore. They start to think about everyone next to them, the giving. So generosity is a big part of what happens. It's like, you know, that guy, Dr. Larry from, have you read Love Everyone? You know that?
No, I know who he is. Larry Brilliant?
Yeah, Larry Brilliant, who's, you
is
know.
Is his last name involved. Really Brilliant?
It really is. Wow. And you can get this book, Sometimes Brilliant, which is a wonderful his story, which is really pretty powerful, where Maharaji got him to join the UN and eradicate smallpox back in the 70s. Anyhow, he was, I'll just tell this little story because to me it says the whole thing. He really didn't get Maharaji, but his wife made him come there. And he came there and he got ignored by Maharaji the whole time. And then finally he decided, this is not for me. He told his wife, look, I got to go. I can't handle this. And she said, all right, well, you tried, but at least come back one time and say goodbye. He said, okay. And he went out, and that night he was in a town, there was a lake, and he was out in the lake in a boat, and he just said to himself, God, please give me some kind of sign. This is so much suffering. I don't want to lose my wife, and you know, I'm not into this. Anyhow, this happened. He goes there the next day to say goodbye to Maharaji. And one of the things that was really hard for him was bowing down and touching anybody's feet.
Sure.
He couldn't do it.
That's right? Hard for a lot of people.
We can all relate.
Yes.
That's a lot of people. It was me too. I had, not with him, but with who I was with, the other, you know, teachers in India, yogis and so on, and I couldn't do it. And when I mean, that's a whole other story, what happened to me when I did get there. But Larry, so he's sitting in front of the bench where Maharaji is outside his room, and he would come out and sit on and hang with people. And he was just sitting there, and he saw there was some flowers that people had arranged on the blanket, on the bench, tucket it's called, and a couple of them had fallen off. So he went down, he was going to pick them up and put them back on the bench, and as he did that, as soon as he put his hand on the flower, Maharaji barged out of the door and and put his foot on Larry's hand, and Larry couldn't move. Everything he, you know, so exactly what he was freaked out about, he had no choice. Maharaji just kept his foot there and looked at him, and Larry looked up, and, you know, Maharaji was just twinkling, you know. And then Maharaji said to Larry, "So you were out last night, you were out boating on the lake?" And Larry said, "Yeah." "You asked for a sign from God?" You know. So anyhow, Larry, between the foot incident and all of that, his whole world just cracked, you know. He cracked open at that point. But what he said was, eventually, he said, "I know this being, his job is to love everybody. That's what gurus do." So, you know, that was nothing surprising about that. But what was surprising was I was sitting around and I loved all of these Westerners, or all of these people, not just Westerners, that were sitting around me. That was the miracle.
Right.
And that's kind of the miracle of you know, us, you know, when we go to Maui, being able to hang out in that group and care about other people, not just ourselves. And you, I think that's a big thing.
That's a big thing. And, you know, and I think that is something that can happen out there. But also another thing that happens.
It can happen anywhere, by the way. This isn't out there.
Sure.
It's any, you know, any place where, what did Christ say? Where two or three gather in my name, there I am.
But I'm talking about, I mean, this is kind of, it's not in the direction I wanted to go in, but when you're at these retreats or any time you start meditating again, it isn't, I mean, I think Raghu, what you're talking about is something that happens maybe a little later on, but I know for a lot of people who go to these retreats, and even for a lot of people who meditate alone or go to any kind of gathering of something that isn't based on eating together or buying shit, you know, or a concert, anytime you gather with a group of people to express gratitude or to try to heal yourself or go into yourself,
pursue truth,
you run into some roadblocks, which are what you're talking about, the thing Hahnemann wanted withdrawn. And that's pretty uncomfortable. And I think at these retreats, every single time I kind of stumble into them imagining, oh, this is like a vacation. And every single time I'm challenged with something. And it's a slow burn for me. It's like the seeds get planted, and then a week, 2 weeks later, that's when I start processing it. And it starts, anyway, so I know what you're saying. It is like that at its best. But I think it's also very challenging in the best way possible for people.
Yeah.
But I want to talk, so I hear what you're saying, that the miracles, potentially even the fixation on the other, is almost secondary to connection with the soul or love, which is probably the same thing. But I still want to know what is the general premise about where these beings, because I people don't just see them as a mythological fairy, as a fairy tale. People believe that there is a Hanuman, some kind of, I don't know what you'd call it, a god, an entity, a field of consciousness that is real. And when you're saying that you are communing with Maharaji, you don't mean in a, you're making it up. And in fact, I would imagine you downplay it a little bit. But I want to know where these things are. Where is the field of consciousness that is Hanuman? Where is the field of consciousness that is Neem Karoli Baba? Where, you know, people say, Jesus is in your heart. Jesus is always with us. Where does it exist in the universe? Is it like a vapor? Is it in the material universe? Is it in some alternate dimension? Is it detectable? What do you think?
I haven't the slightest idea. I'm just happy someone like you is really trying to think about these things. Somebody should be thinking about
them. Well, because if we can find out where it is, we can capture them.
Capture?
I'm just kidding.
No, there's no capturing.
I'm just kidding. No, I'm kidding. Capturing. I'm kidding. I'm kidding. But no, I think it's important to think about. Because
really?
I do. I think it is important to think about. I think it's... because I'll tell you what. I think it's...
You can't... But this is stuff you're talking about that you can't know. There's no way rationally in your mind to come up with, I mean, eventually maybe, and they are making huge strides where, like, you know, all that stuff the Dalai Lama's doing with neuroscience and so on, you know, finding the scientific parallels to deep meditation states and, you know, the molecular structures.
Yes.
So they are working on that, and I suppose at some point in a distant or near future, they will find something that is explainable. All I can tell you is I'm just happy I met that thing. I don't know where that thing is. The stuff that goes on when we get together in groups and we all focus on that one thing, which is to become. Yeah, to not pay so much attention to our little puny selves.
Yes.
And get out of ourselves, however which way you want to call what we do. And then we have that feeling of connectivity. So that connectivity is what this thing is. And to call it love, that's such a shit word. Nobody,
yes.
You know, it means nothing. You know, it gives us some indication, I guess, you know, and say unconditional love would meaning you're not asking for anything in return from these people you happen to be with. You're just joyfully with them. That space gets created. I mean, this is going really a little personal, but not more than 4 or 5 days ago, I had a dream of Maharaji. I haven't dreamt of him in, it's been years, a couple of years. I kept saying, you know, where are you? That's your question, too. Where the hell are you?
Yes.
You know? And anyway, I won't go into the details of it. It was all about he was putting people into samadhi, actually. And I kind of fell asleep while I was with him and was wondering what's preventing me from going. You know, he was asking me questions and stuff. Anyhow, the real point that I wanted to make, so in the dream, he was, you know, completely present and I could feel him. And then as I started to wake up from being asleep in the dream, which maybe I was in some other state of consciousness and I was thinking it was sleep, I dropped down. I could feel myself drop from whatever plane that is, coming down through another plane where I was like, oh shit, he's here, meaning on the physical plane. I actually experienced I don't think I've had this happen to me before. The travel from one plane to another.
Wow.
And then snap, I woke up.
That's wild.
Yeah. So that was the first time that ever happened to me. So there is, so that to me is, you know, that was totally experiential. I mean, it wasn't me thinking about anything. It happened. And so that shows me that there are, you know, many planes of consciousness. And so a being like this, who, when he was in a physical body, he was on these different planes of consciousness and could do anything because he was one with whatever you want to call that thing, God, no mind, Buddha mind, whatever, you know, whatever, all the names there are for that which has gone beyond and is part of the fabric of the universal intelligence.
The fabric of the universal intelligence. And, yeah. And I think that is a real fabric. And I want to know, I'm very curious about it, especially, particularly the planes that you're talking about. And the infinite reports people give of these places. I'm very interested in that right now. I love thinking about it. And I want to ask you some more questions about that, but I was hoping you could describe to the listeners what it means to go into samadhi, and have you ever gone into samadhi?
I've gone into states of absorption, not to the... samadhi is you are completely, utterly absorbed. You have no consciousness whatsoever of physical plane, body, or anything. And there are many levels of the depth of samadhi.
What does samadhi mean?
Complete absorption into the one, you could say. Into the reality of the one. So you are no longer two. There's no object, you know, you're not, there's no object. There's no nothing. There's no, you're completely... beyond duality in that moment. You remember the famous saint Sri Ramakrishna?
Yes.
Yeah. So he would get, so here's a good example. His whole thing was to worship the goddess, mother, right?
Yes.
And he would become so absorbed in her that he would go into samadhi. And he would, you know, you see those pictures of him where he's standing and he's just completely like a stone. Maharaja used to put people in samadhi around us, Indians. And
just Indians? He never did it to Westerners?
No, not in front of me that I know of. Obviously, we didn't have the karmas to do that. The body couldn't handle it. I don't know. No, it never happened to any one of us. I know some of us went into deep absorption states, which is what I mentioned before. But this one guy, he put into samadhi, and Maharaji said, try and pick him up. So one guy, you couldn't, I mean, he was like heavy as like a 2,000-pound, you know, huge boulder. It took six guys to pick him up. He said, pick him up and put him in the room. And they put him in the room, and then Maharaji went in the room. We heard this slapping and slamming going on. And then he walked out with the guy who looked like he had just been asleep for 3 months and was just, you know, in a coma and just woke up. So it's
that is really, really intense, man. Like, yeah. I cannot imagine what would be going through my head if I was hanging out in that kind of an environment with you back then. That is so strange. And you know, the one piece, these stories, the one thing that unfortunately you can't add to them is what people call Shakti, which is just the energy of being around these people. So if for those folks listening who haven't experienced it, I think I have. And it is really intoxicating, and it's very psychedelic. So to be in that field while that kind of just, from the rational perspective, that kind of lunacy is happening, it is so overwhelming that I just can't imagine what would happen. People must have fled from him too, Raghu. People must have gone running out of there terrified. Not in the sense that they felt like they were in danger.
Yeah, no.
But in the sense that nobody did that.
It was all, oh, wow. I mean, I remembered actually two of the women that were women, you know, that we were in our 20s at that time, early 20s, girls, were, oh, there's a beautiful story. We're working on this movie of one of our mentors from India for Love, Serve, Remember Foundation. His name was K.C. Tewari. And any of you out there have ever heard Krishnadas or gone to one of his concerts, he talks about him all the time as his Indian father. He was one of the major examples of Maharaji putting people in samadhi. There's actually a film where you can see Maharaji smacking him in the head, bringing him out of samadhi.
I've seen that many times. I've watched that many times.
Day before Maharaji left his body, died. Anyhow, so these two girls, early 20s, are sitting in a room, and this guy, K.C. Tewari, is in the room, and Maharaji puts him in samadhi. And he says to this woman, actually, his name is Radha, what's going on with him? What's going on? She said, I don't know. He seems to be in samadhi. He said, oh, you want to do that? And she goes, yeah, no, I don't know. And then she actually, as you expressed, you know, that might happen, she got very afraid that if this happened to her, she couldn't handle it. So she was really afraid. And she said to, and so he came out of it. And she just tells this beautiful story in the movie, actually, which hopefully will be done in next year at some point. She says, what's going on? What's happening? She actually laughed hysterically when it happened. She said she was so afraid she went into a hysterical thing. You know, where some people, like, they get afraid, they laugh hysterically.
Yes.
Yeah. And she said, could this happen to me, to Tewari? And he kept shaking his head back and forth, and he'd go, he could do this to a boulder. He could do this to a stone. And she completely freaked out in that moment. Oh, God, yeah. So, yeah, I guess some of us did, but mostly, like, I was with Tewari with my mother once. And this is long after Maharaji left his body. We went on a pilgrimage, and we were together one night, and he said to us, Tewari said, you don't give up your religion, you know, to take on an Eastern religion. You know, you got to keep, you have to keep your original thing with you. And he said, so you're Jewish? And we went, yeah. He said, well, you must know, a Jewish prayer of some sort. Could you do it? Could you sing it? So my mother and I started singing one of the Jewish prayers from the High Holidays, which is, it's called Enkeloheinu, for those of you who know it.
Can we hear a little bit of it?
Enkeloheinu, Enkadoneinu. It means there is only the one. There's nothing but the one. Hmm. Okay? That's kind of the meaning of it.
Cool.
He went into samadhi.
Wow.
While we were doing it. My mother, who had never seen anything like this, she goes, holy God, what happened to him? I said, well, let's say he's with God right now. Well, what are we going to do? No, we don't do anything. Eventually he'll come out of it. And eventually he did. And then a little later than that, my mother started talking about how my mother loved clean houses, clean everything. She was a clean freak, right?
Yes.
And she said to him, you know how I feel about God? Cleanliness is next to godliness. You know that expression?
Sure.
She said, cleanliness is next to godliness. He went into samadhi again.
So why do you think some people have more of a tendency to enter into this state of consciousness than other people?
Yeah, he was a high yogi. That's why. He was in the guise of a principal of a boys' school in the Himalayan foothills in Nainital. But in reality, he was a very high yogi with powers. And you'll see this in the movie. I can't wait for y'all to see this movie because his sons describe the insanity of what all kinds of miracles happened around him. Jai Utal, right, who some of you may know, is also an amazing chant guy, tells the most incredible story of this guy, this miracle that happened one day with ash coming out of Maharaji's pictures right in front of him. Anyhow, so you have to have extraordinary gazillions of lifetimes of practice to obviously get to the point where there is nothing in your way to be completely absorbed into the one.
Well, it seems like the main thing that's in the way is that you have a body.
No, ego. The thing with the body is you can't be like a meat eater or something. You can't, you can't be, he ate incredibly pure. He didn't eat a lot either, Tiwari. But whatever he ate, of course, most Indians are vegetarians, but he was on a very restricted diet anyhow because of he had diabetes and all that. But your body has to be very pure, and the channels, which are called nadis, if anybody out there knows it through yoga, have to be very attuned and clear, so that the energy, the shakti you just mentioned, that passes through you in these states isn't getting blocked, through the energy system in the body. So
second chakra, baby.
You clean up your chakras, eh?
Second chakra, baby.
Yeah, so he wasn't stuck there. 90.9 of us are stuck there, either there or in the third power chakra.
Oh, really? Second and third, that's where everyone's all damned up, huh?
One, two, three.
The first is survival. Second is sex. Third is power.
Yeah, and then from there, and it's not to say we're not also, many of us, who have a realization that there is a path and there is a way to become free of being stuck in number one, two, or three, you're also operating in number four, which is the heart, which is what we started this whole conversation about.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad we landed here too, because I think that what you're talking about, the energy blockage in these second and third chakras, we're witnessing this on a national level right now.
Yeah,
which is that
it's amazing, isn't it?
Yes.
One, two, three are really coming out. Beyond the beyond.
That's right, and we're all trying to get into the heart, and we know that's the only way that we're going to survive. And we all can feel it. We know it. We can feel it, and that's what I think. We're kind of witnessing with the beginning of the legalization of marijuana, and even in California, they're putting. Did you know this, Raghu? They're putting psilocybin on the ballot. Did you know this?
No.
They're going to try to legalize mushrooms, psychedelic mushrooms, and I think.
For use with PTSD.
I think for recreational purposes, but I haven't looked at it. Yes, but I think that
we have to talk to Bruce Margolin about that.
For sure, it's really interesting, but I think that these are all examples of a kind of dawning realization that we need to take steps, drastic steps, personally, nationally, globally, to try to get people into their heart and out of their, power or sex. And this is something I want to talk to you about. It is when you realize that your entire life and most everything that you do is actually just based on these two things, sex and power.
And survival.
And you realize your pattern, your whole pattern, is just manipulation, whether you like it or not. And that your whole identity that you have formed a life around is essentially just an energy blockage.
Mm-hmm.
This, I think, is why people don't want to go into samadhi. Because...
It's not a matter of not wanting. It's a matter of incapable of. There's no way it's going to happen.
Right. Even that. I think that's a deeper level of the same problem, which is that... it's almost as though our entire national identity is frozen in the first two chakras, three chakras. It's almost as though the entire concept of how to exist as a state is located in those three chakras.
That's been forever. That's not now. That's forever.
I'm telling
you. Forever and ever since the dawning of...
to get to the point, though, on a personal level, when we start practicing, there's changes are coming. What is it Krishnadas says? Something like, it's not easy, but he's got this great saying about it. But you hear it in different ways, which is, you know, when you talk about it, Raghu, and you talk about looking around next to the people at the retreat and love is happening, you want to give. This is coming from someone who's spent an entire lifetime pretty much practicing. You've done a lot of work, and it shows. But to get to that point, you've told me stories, and Ram Dass certainly has stories, and Krishnadas has stories, and people in other spiritual paths and practices and religions all have these same stories, which is that the progression from the initial, the first three chakras out of those into the heart is not smooth sailing. It brings up a bunch of shit and you got to deal with it. In the same way, on a national level, we got to do the same fucking thing, which is we got to deal with a lot of shit, man. And it's real. And we're watching it happen right now. This like wavering decision between a being that's literally driven by the desire to control power and sex, the pussy grabber, you know, and the potential for there to be something that isn't based on that kind of identity on a national level. And it's fascinating to watch because it's something in it is kind of apocalyptic, because it's like, man, if we don't figure it out for ourselves personally, and I mean for myself, the older I get and the more I work with you guys and you, the more I realize if I don't do this is serious work. It's not something that it's serious. It's as serious as anything else. If you don't want, as Sharon Salzberg says, I think Sharon Salzberg said this. Do you want to just kind of get angrier every day for the rest of your life? Is that what you want? Just kind of every day? Just a little angrier. Just a little angrier every day. A little more like numb every day. Do you want that? Of course you don't. You want to feel again. You want to be in that state of love. You want to be in that place where the clouds part for a second inside of your being, and you feel what you really are, and you realize, my God, I don't need anything but this. I don't need a house. I don't need a lover. I don't need a wife. I don't need food. I just need this. This is all there is. And then the clouds cover that shit up again, and you're thinking about, like, fuck, man, I gotta, like, I gotta get a better internet connection so I can watch Netflix in HD. You know what I mean? But what I'm saying is, and I don't mean to overpressurize it, but it seems like a life or death situation, in the sense that, on the personal level, if you're all numbed up and caught in your head, checking your phone every 8 minutes and swiping your Tinder, and lost in a daze, lost in a dream, moving from states of horniness to anger, bitterness to tiredness, that's not really being alive. And on the same...
Yeah, but...
Go ahead, sorry.
No, I'm just... That is the reality, as I said, from the dawning of time until people, the individual, gets so unhappy with his or her situation that they can't stand it anymore.
Right.
So they do something for themselves, you know. And it can be, of course, in the most common vernacular for many of us was, back in the day, was a psychedelic.
Yes.
And what did that do? That taught us that we are living in an interconnected vibrational zone.
Right.
And we absolutely have to understand that whatever we do affects not just ourselves, but everybody else in one way or another, however subtly or grossly.
Right.
So once you realize that, then, you know, I mean, you're a good example. You did psychedelics. You had Be Here Now, so you had some idea of, you know, what Ram Dass was trying to get at with all of this, and then you pursued it, you know, hard, because it started to become obvious to you, and that's what you're saying right now. It's becoming obvious to us that in order for not just us to be happy, but in order for us to really try and do something about the this boulder, this that's rolling down this mountain and creating this enormous destruction, we've got to do something. And where can we start? You can only start with yourself.
Right.
You know? And so it's not just, okay, I'm unhappier than shit. That's what happened to me. I was just so damn unhappy. You know, the psychedelic turned me into a place, turned me onto a place that I could understand there was a way out. And then, you know, I pursued stuff.
Right.
You know, and I met Ram Dass. I was really lucky. And, you know, many people have that similar story. But then you start to realize when something like what is going on now starts to happen. First of all, there's a collective. I think before we got on, I talked to you about this amazing podcast I did on mind rolling with Robert Svoboda, who wrote these some of the best books on Agora, which is
freaking intense. Hold on. Actually, let me just pause this. I want to read a little excerpt from one of his books. I was just reading it. Do you mind if can I pause this for 1 second, Raghu? I have the book right here.
Yeah, well, actually, you know, let me quote one thing from him before
great.
You quote, so people know what the hell we're talking about. And this is a quote from the first book, Agora, at the Left Hand of God. I have never believed in religion. Religions are all limited because they concentrate only on one aspect of truth. That is why they are always fighting amongst one another, because they all think they are in sole possession of the truth. But I say there is no end to knowledge, so there is no use in trying to confine it to one scripture or one holy book or one experience. That is why I say, when people ask what religion I follow, I don't believe in sex. I believe in incineration. Burn down everything which is getting in the way of your perception of truth. How about that?
Wow.
That is so great. So the Agora, let me just see. Agora literally means unagitated. okay, teaches Agoris, its practitioners, to focus and intensify their craving for reality until they learn how to transcend all that galls the Gora in life. Then no internal or external stimulus, however ordinarily agitating, will be able to interrupt or interfere with their one-pointed guzzling of the nectar of being.
That is so cool. That's way better than what I was going to read. Wow. That is so cool, man. Ah, I love that. I love it. I love it.
Again, we have to, I don't know what you do, you know, on Mind Rolling. I put up stuff on the show notes page with links to people can get these
I'll
books.
I'll put a link there.
You got to link up Robert's Agora books.
Yeah, for sure. I love that. And that, God, that the nectar that you're talking about, that is such an incredible thing to stumble upon inside of you. And I think people accidentally stumble upon it sometimes, and they don't know that they've found it. I think it must be the fountain of youth. I think that's what they were talking about when they were saying there's a fountain of youth. It seems to definitely be located in your heart, and when you connect with it, it is so overwhelmingly beautiful. And that's where it's really hilarious to me about the avoidance of meditation, which I know I certainly am guilty of until after this retreat, and I've been meditating more. But the avoidance of meditation is so funny because it is what we were talking about in the beginning, which is if you sit down and you let yourself just rest, and then you start doing what you're talking about, and then you suddenly are like, fuck, man, I'm fucking unhappy as shit. And then if you're dumb like me, you can start thinking, well, it's the meditation, I guess. Like, you don't realize, like, no, this is seeping out. This must be seeping out in everything I do, in every expression I make, in every word I say. It's not like it's just there when you're meditating or when you're quiet. Of course, duh. But then when that lifts just for a second and you see what's underneath it, then you realize, oh wow, this is the best thing there could possibly be. And if you could connect with that theoretically in a stable way, wow. I don't know what you would be like.
Yeah. And instead of meditation or any practice, you were just saying this. We, you know, when you were talking about what's going on in this country and how overwhelming it seems, and we've got to do something. And what Robert just said here, focus and intensify craving for reality.
Yeah.
Until you learn how to transcend all the galls of life.
Oh, craving for reality.
Yeah. That's what it is. Craving, you know, and that's what we were talking about with Sharon. Getting real. Craving for reality.
Don't even tell. I don't even want to know. I don't even want to know. You know that thing where you tell people that? I don't even want to know. Don't even tell me. I don't even want to know. You know, like, people will do that. But I don't even want to know. Don't even tell me. Don't even tell me. Don't want to know. Don't want to know. That thing.
Yeah.
That thing. I don't want to know. I don't want to know. No. That's the sound of resistance to happiness, because not wanting, actively not like putting your fingers in your ears, trying not to hear what is actually happening in your own life or in the world, because you would rather live in a state of delusion than to live in truth, has got to be insanity.
It's sad, and we've all done it. And it's not like, you know, here we are, we're talking about this stuff, you and I, and you know, there's many moments in our days where we revert to that, you know, putting our fingers in our ears.
Yes.
We don't want to hear, we don't want to know, close our eyes to our own to being honest, self-honest.
Yes.
About where we're at, what our motivations are, and all of that. So it's not like it ends the moment that you know, put all of your, as he said here, you know, just put everything into a craving for reality, it doesn't just end because you say that to yourself.
Right.
Or it ends when you start to actually, on a day-to-day basis, practice what's needed to practice to transcend the difficult emotions. Which brings me to another thing. Can I just mention something? Because talk about, I mean, people, as I said before, you got to get really, until you're really suffering, you don't reach out. You don't pull your fingers out of your ears.
Right.
You don't, you know? I mean, that seems to be the way it is with everybody, you know?
Unless you're just, but it is, certainly we don't need to be on fire to you know, emotionally. I think that theoretically, the happiest person on earth could just as easily do it, but they're going to be less compelled.
Are people who are, you know, wealthy and, you know, their lives are just, a bowl of cherries, but there's a certain emptiness that eventually comes to everybody.
Yes.
When you're not fulfilling a destiny of at least having some relationship with truth.
Yes.
A deeper truth within yourself. So I was going to just give a little commercial for what we're doing at Love Serve Remember Foundation is with Ram Dass. We put together an amazing online course called Transforming Difficult Emotions.
Hmm.
And he really goes through all that we're talking about here, the way that we identify ourselves, what is suffering, you know, how we relate with that part of our life, how we deal with anger, how we deal with unworthiness. And unworthiness is a huge one, right?
Yes.
For many, many, many people, most of us. And then some of the ways in which we, you know, Ram Dass's thing around using witness and that whole thing with, he compares to Gurdjieff's self-remembering. I don't know if you know Gurdjieff?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So that self-remembering thing.
Which the example from In Search for the Miraculous, when Ouspensky is doing this experiment where he's trying to remember himself. He goes by a cigar shop, goes in to get some tobacco, comes to 3 days later. Realizing he's forgotten the experiment, I think, is the story Ram Dass cites.
Yeah. So, anyhow, that'll be available. Just go to ramdass.org, by the way, and just sign up. Make sure your email address is in there, and you'll get notifications. Because a lot of great stuff coming, including the courses.
How much does the course cost, Raghu?
It's not... Everything we do at Ram Dass is free. This one is happening through Shift Network, so I'm not sure what they're going to charge. But you'll see when it's set up. It's not set up yet. It'll be set up in January. You'll see the whole business of it. And there's a lot of stuff with it. Each week you get an incredible meditation thing, videos, audios, PDFs, all of it.
PDFs.
Plus weekly calls, which I'll be on, and some of the other teachers from the retreat.
So you're doing like live streaming talks.
Yeah, well, they're not. All of the material from Ram Dass is pre-stroke, so it's from the archives.
Right.
And then every week after we play the material, then there's a Q&A so people can ask questions.
Cool. That's really cool.
You know, so I'll be there and Ramesh, people like that.
That's super cool, man. That's great.
It might really help exactly what we're talking about. It really might help people to get a handle on dealing with this, with the suffering of difficult emotions, which every day we're afflicted with.
I'll tell you, man. The what I've noticed since I've started sitting. Again, is even though I do find myself confronting a lot of shit, just doing it a little bit, it really changes everything because you're dealing with it. You know, it's like you know, the moment you might have the filthiest house, you might have a hoarder's house, but the moment you just start taking out a little bit of the trash, you get that much more space in the house. Even if it's just an old pile of diapers and a couple of cat carcasses, that's going to make a big difference in your house, you know? And that sense of control, that feeling of like, all right, I'm going to deal with it. It produces such a effect in all these other things that I do, I've noticed. Mm. And it's, so I think it's so easy to under, I'm not saying, obviously, that you get to like, you're going to go into samadhi or anything, but even just like sitting down and looking around and being like, fuck, wow, man, I got to deal with this shit. You know, like there it is. Look at that.
Isn't it? Yeah, it's really great to be acquainted with what's going on deep inside yourself. It's great to be acquainted with it, so it's not hidden. Can I read to you from one other thing?
Yeah, please.
This may help, really, around karma. Every physical or mental action you perform and with which you identify yourself as the doer becomes a karma for you and produces a reaction which you will eventually have to experience.
Wow.
Like everyone else, you consume at each moment of your life that portion of your karmic grain that has finally matured.
Wow.
Likewise, each of your self-identified actions or reactions takes shapes today shapes your future by seeding yet further reactions. Every individual being is a karmic slate of coming attractions and repulsions. Though we all physically share the same earth space and earth time, our individual causative schematic create for us individual universes of experience. There are as many universes as there are beings, each locating the environment, war or peace, wealth or penury, misery or ecstasy, that each assortment of karmas requires. Since limitations in time and, of time and space prevent everything from happening in our world all at once, the law of karma schedules its events to occur just in time, every time, in each cosmos, large and small.
Wow.
Every interaction between two different universes of experience creates its own karma, which duly propagates its own reaction. The more strongly you identify with your karmas, the more closely your experience will conform to the reaction they promise.
Wow.
That's cool. Enough to scare the living shit out of you, right?
Scare the shit out of you.
I did this podcast with Robert. By the end of it, I was going, la, 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 la. Holy
That's
shit.
Funny.
What am I doing on a daily basis creating this stuff?
Well,
thought forms, right?
Well, it is scary. It is terrifying if you're unconscious. I mean, it's just as scary as if you were hammered and somebody made you start driving a semi, know, and you definitely don't want to drive drunk, and you certainly don't want to live drunk. And the promise in what you just said, and what's so beautiful about it, is a few things. One of them is that it really does kind of confirm a lot of magical ideas by controlling your thought patterns, your reactions, and these sorts of karmic thumbprints we're putting into time. You could open up brand new universes for yourself. You could enter into brand new universes. And that's super, super.
So the fact that you came back from this retreat that we've been talking about and referring to, with the kind of inspiration and intention that led you to sit, meditate.
Yeah, we're not going to be able to do it, man. I've lost my bandwidth.
It's what?
No, available. Hang on. I'm sorry, Raghu. I've lost the bandwidth. It keeps fading out. I mean, try to say it one more time quickly, and we can wrap it up. Hopefully it'll work. Maybe try one more time to say what you're saying.
Okay. The fact that you came back from the retreat and you had the inspiration and intention to sit on a day-to-day basis is what it is that we all have the opportunity to do. Get to know ourselves better. Make better friends with ourselves so we can get at the core of who we are and the subtleties that go down on a day-to-day basis that create our worlds.
Yeah, I love it, man. It's such a beautiful thing you guys do. I'm so grateful to know you, and I'm lucky too, man. You say you're lucky. I'm lucky too, and I'm really grateful to you for all the things that you have taught me. Thank you, Raghu. Thanks for being on the show too.
You got it.
Thanks for listening, you guys. That was Raghu Marcus. Remember to go to the Love, Serve, Remember website. They've got a lot of great stuff there if you enjoyed what he was talking about. Big thanks to Squarespace.com for sponsoring this episode. And as always, an eternal thank you to you, my listener. I'll see you soon. Hare Krishna.